Hi, I'm Elvis Mitchell, and thanks for listening to The Treatment. Some of the most entertaining stories produced today, however, are not on the big screen, but they can be heard on KCRW's Unfictional, intimate stories and artful documentaries crafted by some of the most talented radio producers across the world. Check it out. You can find Unfictional on KCRW's iTunes page. From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. I don't know if I've had as much fun in a long time preparing for an interview as I did for today's show with my friend Paul Sador, the editor and the Oscar-nominated director of the terrific documentary short on behind the scenes of the Wild Bunch. He's done a series of books on Sam Peckinpah. His newest book, by the way, has one of my favorite titles of any book of this decade, The Authentic Death and Contentious Afterlife of Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid. First of all, Paul, it's so good to have you back.
Thank you.
And talk about where this title comes from. It comes from Pat Garrett's title of his own book.
Yes, that's true. Well, actually, the full title is The Authentic Death and Contentious Afterlife of Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, The Untold Story of Peckinpah's Last Western Film. Well, I happen to be exceptionally fond of elusive titles. You know, if you look in my book on Peckinpah's Western film, several of the titles are allusions to other things. So this title contains actually two allusions. One is to the book Garrett himself wrote about a year after he killed Billy the Kid. It was published in 1882.
Well, the book that he may have written.
Well, let's put it this way, that Ash Upsom ghost wrote for him, except for the last part, which might have been more dictated than written. But in any event, it's called The Authentic Life of Billy the Kid. Now, that's the short title. However, if you look at the title page,
An Authentic Life of Billy the Kid.
Well, yes, one of them is an authentic. The other is the authentic. It depends on the title page. It's the authentic. And then the title goes on for virtually a paragraph after that, you know, a true and faithful narrative by Patrick F. Garrett, by whom he was hunted down and killed, the noted desperado. And so...
Well, Paul, we're out of time. Thanks for coming by.
That's right. There you go. And then a few decades later, Charles Nider wrote a really splendid Western novel called The Authentic Death of Henry Jones. And he was alluding to doing a coin on Garrett's title. And it's based on the Billy the Kid story, only with changed names. So by doing this, I could allude to both books and also have a bit of fun with how long 19th century titles were. And they always like to get things in it like authentic and faithful and true and all the rest of it. That was just part of the conventions of the time.
We should say we're talking about Sam Peckinpah's beautiful 1973 film, Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid. And one of the things that's run through your books on Peckinpah, which I always find fascinating, is that his incomplete films are the films almost that have the greatest hold on us. And I think that's a fascinating idea.
Well, certainly. It depends on how you define incomplete. You know, The Wild Bunch was completed.
Yes.
It's just that, as with so many of Peckinpah's films, there was a lot of arguing about which version is going to be
released. In fact, you say in the introduction here, you know, his customary...
Yeah, his customary, as I say, contentious relationships. You know, his first film, Western film and film as well, was called The Deadly Companions. And in a strange way, that could have been the title of virtually all the rest of the films, not to mention his relationship with people, with the business end of and the producer end of the thing. And as is often the case with this kind of thing, often those fights were justified. He was fighting the good fight, and often Peckinpah being Peckinpah, they were fought for other reasons, for reasons that this was just his personality, and he could be abrasive and bickering. Because among other things, that was something of the way he got his juices flowing, for instance. And so you can't take that out of the equation. To take the most generous view of it, however, I think that the best producers who worked with Peckinpah realized that this is a dance he had to do. And so they knew how to do it with him. And once he got going and off and running, then you kind of get out of his way and let him do what he does. I mean, this is what Phil Feldman did for most of the length on The Wild Bunch. Richard Lyons did the same thing on Ride the High Country. Joe Wazan certainly did it on Junior Bonner and Foster as well, whereas the others who actually want to get in there and lock horns with him from start to finish, that's not so good. And one of the reasons why it's not so good is that Sam's personality was such that he couldn't stand outside himself and disengage himself from the fight enough to sometimes take a look at the much longer view and say, this is where I want to get. I can let this go here.
But it's interesting because you posit the view that basically after The Wild Bunch, he kind of killed the Western. I mean, because it was the ne plus ultra of Westerns. Yeah. But also, there was that sense of immediacy in his Westerns that didn't exist before that. And it's, as you said, you talk about his own interest in the films of Europe and Asia, which have that kind of immediacy. Yes. And the best Westerns made in this country were still a kind of pulp. And his had an emotional narrative of chaos and betrayal that come from his own life. As you mentioned in the book, you use Pauline Kael's great line, the youngest legendary American director.
Yes.
But I'm going to get back to what I meant by incomplete with films like Major Dundee or Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, the films that got out of his hands. But as you've gone over in the books, these films continue to have a hold on us. And I wonder why you think that is.
Well, for one thing, in the case of Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, it talked about, several people have remarked upon this, there's something really haunting about that film. You know, a lot of the people who really love Peckinpah's work for its energy, Pauline Kael happens to be a good example, you know, who's one of the rare ones to have seen a very early cut of the film. And she came away saying, you know, I think she called it a woozy, druggy piece of work with no motor force to it. And it is true that this film is stylistically in some ways different from a lot of Peckinpah's films. It doesn't move fast. And this was particularly difficult with the people he was working with at the studio who wanted something that moved faster. The additional complication here, however, is that the versions before the previews and then even the preview versions themselves do have very real problems of pacing and so forth that were not at that, for example, the editors wanted to address, and that Peckinpah was not particularly receptive to addressing. He kind of took a really firm stand and said this and no more, even though there's all sorts of evidence, both direct and circumstantial, to suggest that he knew the film wasn't quite working the way he wanted it to work. And this was an example perhaps the first clear example of how his self-destructiveness could often get the better of what was best for the film or what was, you know, best for the good of the film. And your larger point about what made Peckinpah's Westerns different. You know, he famously said the Western is a form that it's possible to comment on today. I'd like to make Westerns the way Kurosawa makes Westerns, he once famously said. And everybody has observed.
But he also once famously says, you have in the book, he doesn't make Westerns, he makes films about men on horses.
Yeah, he makes films about which he's been basted for from some, this is pretentious and so on. He wasn't saying anything of the sort. He said, I don't mind being labeled a director of Westerns, but look, these are my Westerns. And what he meant was how personally involved he was with the issues, the themes, the characters themselves. I mean, he was so identified with Garrett in particular, I think, and in a different way with Billy, that I use the term enmeshed. I mean, he saw in Garrett certainly a lot of the things about himself that he was coming to by that time in his life and career that he couldn't, and not only did he not shy away from them, he actually intensified them in the film. You see his violence toward women, you know. You see the drinking, although in Garrett that comes out in a very special kind of way. We can talk about that if you like.
Yeah, I like to, but also one of the things you get ahead too is this, and you've remarked on this in several of the other books, is the casualness of treason.
Yeah.
There's a casual, and that for me is the most haunting thing about this movie.
By treason, you mean
the betrayal.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things, interestingly enough, that I think, relative to what you said a few moments earlier, one of the things that makes his Western so immediate, that makes his film so immediate, you don't get the kind of buffers of motivation of trying to explain why this is done. This is just what the world is. And then the other instance with Garrett is, the other aspect of the thing with Garrett is, there's a kind of self-betrayal that's going on here. Sam was just, in his films, he was extremely attuned to how divided he himself was and how self-destructive, the lengths of self-destructiveness that dividedness could take him to. And the thing I find wonderful in his movies is that he's not trying to resolve that for us. He's simply wanting to put it out there. You know, one of the things about Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid and all of Peckinpah's films, The Wild Bunch is another, Ride the High Country is another, that drives me a little crazy, is that Peckinpah always sets these values, these systems of belief, these philosophies into conflict. And so naturally, you have people who want to come out there and think, oh, we have to take one side or the other side. You know, in The Wild Bunch, he gave his word to a railroad. It's his word. It's not what counts. It's who you give it to. And the number of people who say, yeah, see, that's what it is. It's who you give it to. I don't see the movie as saying that at all, especially since by the time you get to the end, Pike's point of view reaches its development too. What he wants to do is, in these dramas, make us feel what it's like to have to sustain these antithetical modes, these antithetical feelings, and live with them. That's part of what makes them so powerful. It's also one of the reasons why people think that, people have often said, and I think truthfully, to some extent, his films are morality plays. They're always dealing with, you know, okay, you know, get out. It's going to be kind of, you know, hard to turn your back on all that, isn't it, Pat, you know, at the beginning? And he says, well, times have changed, you know, and you get Garrett, who just says, you know, there's a time in a man's life, he just don't want to figure what's coming next. And Billy says, it'd be kind of, that's not going to like it, coming down hard on him 4 days. So you have Billy as this kind of overgrown teenager who can't quite give up just being contrary to be contrary. I mean, he represents that force of anarchy that we all find appealing at some level too.
And that's a very romantic notion of anarchy,
yes,
too, by the way, which is just that thing that so often pervades, there's always a part of the movies.
Oh, always a part of Peckinpah's films as well. You know, there's a wonderful statement that I found while I was researching the book, and I quoted in a footnote, you know, directors are not necessarily famous for speaking enthusiastically of other directors' work. They don't necessarily strike them down. They're just involved in their own work, and that's it. But there's a wonderful statement that Sidney Pollack made, the director Sidney Pollack, who said there was this romanticism in Sam and this attraction to violence. And he said, you find that in a lot of directors, but Peckinpah was really able to do something with that. That tension between that violence and that romanticism always made his films interesting. He said, I was never bored at a Peckinpah film, and that's something I can't say of anybody else's films, including my own, which I thought was wonderfully generous, a wonderfully generous thing to say. And, you know, the funny thing is that is often what's true of Peckinpah as well, that, you know, one of the things that draws us to him. It's very difficult not to get involved. I mean, even some of his films that I regard as, you know, bad, like the second two-thirds of Killer Elite, which is...
We'll table some of that. We'll get
table
to,
that
we'll,
one.
We'll, yes. Let, we'll have to take a break. That's a great point to take a break, that wonderful Sidney Pollack story. My guest is my friend Paul Sadow. His new book is, and I love saying this title, The Authentic Death and Contentious Afterlife of Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, the untold story of Sam Peckinpah's last Western film. It's a treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
Immerse yourself in Rhythm Planet, hosted by Tom Schnabel, the world music blog and podcast dedicated to history, storytelling, and, of course, the music. Check it out now at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. My guest is Paul Sador. His new book, his terrific new book, the book title is The Authentic Death and Contentious Afterlife of Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, The Untold Story of Peck and Paw's Last Western Film. Here's one of the things I want to get to, because I think it's a really remarkable point that you make, that people undervalue Peck and Paw's adaptations. You go back to the college adaptation he did of Tennessee Williams, and you mentioned Noon Wine. And you also mentioned a terrible book that he turned into a remarkable movie, which is Straw Dogs. Yeah. And then this being an adaptation as well. A de facto adaptation, right. because there's so much great stuff in the book. Just the meetings between Sam Peckinpah and Marlon Brando, when Brando was gravitated towards the original iteration of the script, which ended up turning into the strangest, what I call a surf western, One-Eyed Jacks, the oddest movie ever made. And you know it's no good as you're watching it, and you still can't stop watching it. And in that way, it sort of lends itself to this conversation about these movies that feel, I said incomplete. I don't know if I exactly with the right words. They feel inchoate. Yeah. And certainly One-Eyed Jacks, if you like, and in a way has a spiritual kinship to the movies of Peckinpah, like Major Dundee and Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, these movies that are missing a step.
Right. Well, in the case of One-Eyed Jacks, you know, I mean, Brando himself admitted 40 years later, whatever it is in his biography, he says, I mean, he shot so much footage. And after a while, I just got bored with it and left. I mean, that's what he said. I left it and left the editor to figure. I happen to be not only extremely fond of it, I'm quite batty about One-Eyed Jacks. I think it's just so remarkable a film. And what we were talking about, you know, a bit before the show started, I think one of the reasons for One-Eyed Jacks, why it continues to have its hold, is unquestionably the performances. Put anybody else but Brando and Maldon, Slim Pickens and you put anybody else in that thing, and I think the whole edifice just topples. It just falls to pieces. But you have them in. And one of the reasons, by the way, why I began the book with One-Eyed Jacks is that I wanted to begin with Peckinpah. Because that was his, you know, then we go back and we go from Garrett to Niter to Peckinpah's screenplay and then to Wurlitzer and then to Peckinpah's Changes. So that began, that was a way of beginning with Peckinpah. But it was also, I now realize, but I can't honestly say this was in my conscious mind at the time, it also is a way of beginning with all the things that you would just mention. It begins with the notion of something that is not quite finished or something that goes many different hands get into it until it becomes something rather different from what it started out to be.
But I find myself really, because I went and pulled out something I haven't read since college, reading Billy Budd, Herschel Parker, and that idea of one man seeing in another man his own deficiencies.
Right.
And it's so beautiful that you bring that up and that you mentioned Parker in the opening of the book. And I wonder how big a catalyst that was for you, because I think that's a book that people need to go and seek out, because it's all, not only is it about the beauty of the writing, and this book is about the beauty of the movie and all the lives that led to the movie, but still, finally, the core of it is about the beauty of that movie, finally.
Well, Herschel's been a dear friend for a long time and a mentor and wonderfully encouraging with the book, and he's read several of them. But the funny thing is that I had written most of the book when I went back. I was reading Herschel's new book at the time, which was Melville Biography, An Inside Narrative, which is a fabulous book. I recommend it to everybody. Also, from Northwestern University Press. And so I got the Billy Budd book and began looking through that again. And there was just that wonderful statement at the beginning that I just wanted to quote, where he says, you can't treat Billy Budd as a finished work. If you try to treat it as a completed work, what happens is, particularly with the character of Vere, Melville did not resolve it. He left two different, that's reducing it to simplistic thing, but fair enough. He left two different views of Vere in the book that are never really, you have no way of doing it. And so I wanted that to be sounded at the beginning of this book, because I think the one fact about Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid that's so much criticism, and I think there's a lot of good criticism of this film. I think there's a lot, not a lot, but there's some that's not so good. But what none of them seems to want to accept is that this is an unfinished work. And so you have to, and unless you're prepared to accept that, then, well, it's going to wind up being contentious in ways that that the discussion doesn't have to be contentious.
It's the treatment my guest is Paul Sadow. His terrific new book, which I love, I love this book, The Authentic Death and Contentious Afterlife of Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, a book about all the things that led to the making of Peck and Paul's, I think, startlingly inchoate but gripping masterpiece, Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid. It's funny, too, because all these things, they're all about pieces. They're all about shards.
Yeah.
And that's something you're really good at. I mean, finding these things that you see where the pieces are missing, and you write about those shards first, and then you go back from there. And I find myself thinking, as you were talking about it, because I just, when reading that last section, I thought, yeah, that's it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And for me, it was a tap on the side of the beaker that way. You are attracted to these unfinished things.
Right.
But that session where you mentioned Jim Kitsis writing about the atypical painterly scene in the movie Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, it's a scene that so many people talk about.
Right, I know.
And it's a scene that actually, when there are films, even the Peckinpah documentary, that shot is in the movie.
Yeah.
Talk about that scene and
you're talking about the scene by the lake.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, you know, you just have Billy entering from screen left, walking in silhouette, riding in silhouette, pauses in the lake, and then moves on. And, you know, you have this wonderful dual reflection of the kid, which Kitsis, I think, analyzes and interprets very, very beautifully. But it comes to the point of this is kind of the negation of the myth, the, you know, America dark and dead in the water. And I think that's fine. The trouble is, if you quote that image, like you quote it in a book, this is part of the problems with trying to quote films. You can't quote static images. That sometimes works with David Lean or John Ford, say, because this was their style. This was really a painterly style. But with Peckinpah's, it's moving. And so the figure comes in. So you see him moving against the skylight, silhouetted. Then he pauses and you see him reflected. And then he moves on and kind of disappears into the landscape. And to me, if you're going to interpret this metaphorically in some way, one way you interpret it is that's the evolution of the myth as well. That the kid is heroic, you know, he's iconic. You know, then he moves and you get this dupal view of him, positive or negative, and then he kind of disappears into the landscape, which anticipates, by the way, what happens to Garrett in one of the endings of the film, where Garrett, you know, who doesn't quite achieve the mythic status, he just disappears into the West. So one of the things I kind of like to insist upon with Peckinpah is you really do have to grant him a complexity in his images, in his conceptions, and so forth, that you don't find in a lot of the directors of Western films and even in other films as well. And, you know, the way he uses conventions, for example, I mean, I invoke Beethoven, and I'm not meaning to be pretentious. This is my favorite composer. I mean, my daughter, the first thing my daughter learned, music she learned when she was 13 months old, was bum, 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 bum. So anyway, but, you know, Charles Rosen has pointed out how Beethoven would take the most banal cliches and he would kind of reduce them almost to their essence, and you would realize again what power they had.
But it's that thing, that immediacy I was talking about, and that emotional narrative, these things that tend to not exist because Westerns tend to be more about archetypes than people.
Yeah.
But I guess I wonder, too, why you feel, and you talk about in the book, which is why I'm going to ask you this is such a departure from all those. It's a different kind of immediacy. It's a dreamy immediacy here, and it's allusive rather than illustrative. And you get at some of those things in the book.
Well, I think, you know, one of the wonderful things about Sam is that, you know, one critic once said of him early on, his range is narrow, but at least he is at home on it. I think that was Stanley Kaufman, by the way. I think his range was much greater than that. But the thing is that look at his work superficially, and you might say he's repeating himself. look at it, give it the care. Yeah, I'm glad to see you're puzzled by that, because I would say the same thing. The reality is that even when Peckinpah was at his most narrow, he was amazingly not repetitive. And by the time he got to Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, I mean, not only was he able to do something or try again to do something that he wanted to do 15 years earlier at the beginning of his career, but this time I think he realized that he had a different story to tell. He told the story about the heroic demise in The Wild Bunch.
And to some extent in Major Dundee as well.
Yes, and also to a simpler and purer extent even in Ride the High Country.
Sure.
So he had kind of done all that, and this time he realized that he had a different story to tell, and he specifically wanted to tell a different story. This is why I'm so proud of the very ending of the book, which came to me thanks to Don Hyde, Sam's archivist, almost like a gift when Don mentioned that to me. And he said, you know, he looked at Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid and he said, "That's what I was trying to do in The Wild Bunch and I didn't succeed." And what the hell did he meant by that? And Sam didn't say what he meant by that to Don, but I just got to thinking. I mean, in The Wild Bunch, he said, you know, "I wanted to make a story about heavies. I wanted to make a story about how bad the bad guys were." Well, he did, except that by the time he gets to the end here, the manner of their passing is so audacious. He just knew that he had made a film about heroism. I mean, the twisted, tortured path to heroism and myth. When he gets to Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, one of the things that I'm literally awestruck when I get to the end of this film, vis-a-vis the earlier one, is that at the end of The Wild Bunch, you have this conflagration, this Homeric battle that seems to go on forever, and yet it's timed exactly right.
It's both distended and intensified.
And intensified, absolutely. And then you have this extraordinary coda where they do become heroes. Think about Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid. This builds in Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid. The build is toward a single shot when Billy turns and Garrett rises up, and it's a single shot, and then this is followed by the shot of Garrett at his own reflection in the mirror. And Elvis, that's as devastating as the 200 deaths at the end of The Wild Bunch.
I think more so.
Because it's really the death
of ego. I mean, it's really saying that the legacy he wants to leave doesn't exist.
It doesn't exist. And yes, and there are, I mean, at the end, there's no heroes. There's no heroics. It is just, and here it is. I mean, the end of this way of life is just this. It's death. I mean, he even, talk about being bold in this, you know, in The Wild Bunch. I don't know what you're expecting when that final battle is over, but the last thing you want is to hear the bounty hunters come in and say, "Look at this. This is going to be a picnic." And yet Peckinpah is being truthful to his materials.
I wish we could talk about this forever. We're out of time. Paul, I can't thank you enough. The book, the terrific book by my friend, editor Paul Sador, Oscar-nominated filmmaker Paul Sador, is The Authentic Death and Contentious Afterlife of Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, The Untold Story of Sam Peckinpah's Last Western. Paul, it's a pleasure having you. Thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you, Elvis.
The show is recorded and mixed by Melissa Morton. It's edited and produced by Jenny Radelet. I Want to Enter My House Justified is The Treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica. That I need.